Well, it's certainly a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the organizers also for inviting me. And I should say that I think I am. Well, this is just a blackboard. I mean, I'm going to use it, but just put it on the blackboard. Well, no. I think it will be clear enough, I hope. Each time I'm going to move it over, and I think it's visible enough. So first let me just put quickly, so on some of these I'm going to go quite quickly and on some quite slowly, and so you can cogitate over on the next screen. I think it's visible. So here, these are just some references, and I probably will be mentioning these symbols later. So the first is a paper of mine called the complete separable extension property. Then there's two follow-up papers, one with Timur Oikberg and one with Alvaro Arias. And then there is a paper to appear in the AMS memoirs with Hagerup and Sukachev. And so let's see if this is, so is it actually visible? More or less? Less. Less. Okay. Oh. At least half of it. Well, that's not so good, though. Well, better than nothing. So a non-commutative Banach space, this is an operator space. And I should say that I'm interested in Banach space properties of C-star algebras, non-commutative LP spaces. I'm looking at them as Banach spaces, and I became quite fascinated with their Banach space structure. The correct vehicle for understanding these is through the notion of an operator space, so let me just quickly review this notion. So this is a closed linear subspace of B of H, endowed with the natural tensor product norm on X tensor K. So this is, K denotes the compact operators on little L2, in other words, infinite dimensional separable Hilbert space. And if you take the tensor product of two operators on a Hilbert space, one Hilbert space crossed with another, then this is again a bounded linear operator. And now if you have two spaces of operators, then if you take the tensor products of all the operators in there, you have a natural norm defined. So this is the basic concept. You can think of X tensor op K, which I mean the closure or the completion of this thing, as a Banach space of matrices, infinite matrices, all of whose entries come out of X. If X is separable, this op animal will also be separable. And Ruan succeeded in characterizing these things abstractly, so you don't need the ambient Hilbert space. But just as with C-star algebras, I find that thinking of the thing stuck in a Hilbert, operating on a Hilbert space is a good way. So now one has the notion of a completely bounded map between two operator spaces. So what does it mean to say that a map is completely bounded? Maybe it's better to put it up there. Okay. So this means that the map tensor with the identity on the compacts is bounded. And equivalently, it's defined on the tensor product and then automatically extends to the closure. Equivalently, you can set Tn to be the tensor product of T with the identity on the n by n matrices. And then if you set T twiddle to be T tensor the identity on the n by n matrices, this maps this. So here you have an n by n matrix whose elements are coming out of X. And then T twiddle simply maps that n by n matrix over to this n by n matrix. And so you just take T sub n to be the norm of this guy. And, you know, these things are just naturally operating on the n. You take little L2, for example, add to itself n times. So this is just, I want to say that these things are intuitive. I don't find that, you know, a lot of times things are presented abstractly. Okay, so then one has a little theorem that T is completely bounded if and only if this limit of these n by n things goes, is bounded, and then this the limit is a soup, and this is really the completely bounded norm. And as I mentioned, Ruan's axioms abstractly characterize these, and with his axioms, the field of operator spaces was born. So now you have natural Banach space notions, which quantize when you have the notion of complete boundedness. So completely bounded maps, these are the morphisms that we're interested in. That's backwards. Okay. So an operator, so two operator spaces. So what does it mean to say that X and Y are completely isomorphic? It means that you have a bijection such that T and T inverse are completely bounded. Now, right away, there's a little trouble. Even if T is one-to-one and onto and completely bounded, it doesn't follow that that they are completely isomorphic. But on the other hand, if you just think about the real object is this X tensor K. So if this guy is one-to-one and onto, then it's true that they're completely isomorphic. So this is the, you have to keep this in mind, that you're really dealing with these matrices all the time. But then you have natural notions. X is completely complemented in Y if there's a completely bounded projection from Y onto X. And if lambda completely complemented, that means that the projection can be chosen of norm at most lambda. Whoa. So as I say, this is the right language, in my opinion, to study the Banach space properties of C-star algebras and non-commutative LP spaces. That's impossible to see what time it is. Okay. And so the first part of this talk is, so if A is a C-star algebra, then I'm pointing out here that the dual is a non-commutative L1 space. And for example, if you take the dual of the compact operators, then that dual is trace class. And so that's often thought of as non-commutative little L1 is trace class operators. So the first part of this talk, really, besides this introduction, is what are some results and open problems about C-star algebras themselves. And recall that this is, we are just taking a closed subalgebra of B of H, the bounded operators on H, which is star closed, adjoint closed. And the abstract definition is that this is a Banach algebra with involutions satisfying this magical equality that the norm of X star X is equal to the norm of X squared. And so the famous theorem is that every abstract C star algebra is C star isomorphic to a concrete one. And so nowadays people don't really distinguish the two. Then there are also Feynman algebras, so that's a strong operator topology closed, star closed unital subalgebra of B of H. And when we talk about Feynman algebras, usually it's the pre-dual. To me, it's the non-commutative L1 space, which is the pre-dual, which is important. So the first class of C-star algebras are the main class that I wanted to talk about are the nuclear ones. So the definition of a nuclear C-star algebra is that there's exactly one pre-C-star norm on A tensor B for all C-star algebras B. So what that means is that there's exactly one norm, as I've written over there, on the algebraic tensor product. Now, as a Banach spacer and not an algebraist, this is a pretty definition which meant nothing to me, and I've probably heard it for years and years. And then it turns out that, I can be correct if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's credited independently to Kirschberg and to Choi Ephros that there's an equivalent formulation in terms of an approximation property. And it's that approximation property which makes it feel like the nuclear C-star algebras are really the right Banach space analog of C of K spaces. And of course, there are many other C-star algebras that are important. B of L2 is not a nuclear C-star algebra, and that's important. But when you're thinking about the Banach space structure, it's the nuclearity, which really, I think, saves the day. And so this is nuclear C-star algebra is one which has this approximation property. Another way to say it is that you have a net of contractions which tends pointwise to the identity, but each contraction uniformly, in fact, contractively factors through the n-by-n matrices. So I like to state things without nets. And you can say that for every finite dimensional subspace and epsilon greater than zero, you find the pair of operators from the algebra into Mn and V from Nn into the algebra, and where U and V are complete contractions, and VU minus the I, VU is almost the identity on F. So that's actually. That I think that refinement may be due to Smith. Oh, I'm wrong. It's this is due to PZA that, in fact, instead of insisting that those are complete contractions, you can just insist that they're completely. That their CB norms are completely bounded. And thus one obtains that if a C-star algebra is, if B is a C-star algebra which is completely isomorphic to a nuclear C-star algebra, then so is B. So, in other words, nuclearity is preserved by complete isomorphisms. And for me as a Banach spacer, I wondered, well, I'm still wondering, suppose that they are Banach isomorphic. Is it the case that if one is nuclear, the other is? So when I say Banach isomorphic, I mean forget the operator space structure, but isomorphic means linearly homeomorphic. It doesn't mean isometric. It just means linearly homeomorphic. So this is an open problem, and I'll mention a couple of things about it. Well, this is really okay. Well, so in particular, as far as the definition of nuclearity is concerned, nuclear C-star algebras have the metric approximation property. For a while, it was thought that might characterize them, but there are known C-star algebras, subalgebras of nuclear C-star algebras with the metric approximation property, which are not nuclear. And that was discovered by Hagerup, who proved a very nice positive result that the C-star, reduced C-star algebra on the free group with any number of generators, I put two there, has the metric approximation property. However, it is a case that if a C-star algebra is nuclear, actually its dual has the metric approximation property. And so, I asked Uffe, and he said he didn't know, so I'm asking it now in general. I think it could be true, but anyway, maybe that characterizes nuclearity. So suppose you have a C-star algebra whose dual has the approximation property. Does that imply the C-star algebra is nuclear? So as I, if you think of B of L2, then, of course, B of L2 fails. It's a deep theorem of Shankowski that that fails the approximation property, and so, of course, its dual must. So, of course, if the answer is yes, this would solve the previous problem, and there are other ways of approaching this problem. So, it would solve it in the affirmative. Usually when I ask a question, I believe the answer is yes. So, but I'm not bold enough to conjecture, I just ask. So in these cases. So examples of nuclear C-star algebras, well, of course, C of K-spaces, that is to say commutative C-star algebras. So that's an example. And the nuclearity is witnessed by the fact that it's paved by L infinity n's using partitions of unity. So in fact, you are really factoring through L infinity n instead of through mn. If A star separable, then A is nuclear, and more generally, type 1 C star algebras are nuclear. So, as a Banach spacer, I wanted to know what does type 1 mean, and I'm going to tell you what it means as a Banach spacer. So, there are no representations and there are no anythings like that. First of all, if you take a C star algebra, then I want to explain what type 1 means. The double dual is a Feynman algebra. So so that's a standard theorem. And then a type 1 C star algebra, A is type 1 if and only if its double dual is a type 1 Feynman algebra. So of course, if you don't know what type 1 Feynman algebra means, this is about as good as type 1 C star algebra. On the other hand, then you find a theorem usually stated at the back of, if you're lucky, that there is actually a picture of a type 1 Feynman algebra, and that is this. You take B of H, where H is some Hilbert space, and mu is some finite measure on a finite measure space. So now this is kind of something we can understand. It's L infinity of mu valued in B of H. Its pre-dual is L1 of mu valued in the trace class on H. And now you take an L infinity sum of such guys. So type 1 Feynman algebras are just the L infinity sums of these guys. So in a sense, those are the classical kind of things we might understand if you're in Banach spaces. You take L infinity sums, a family might be uncountable, and that's what a type 1 Feynman algebra is, if you're lucky enough to find that at the end of a 400-page book with a lot of theory in it. So they're, in a way, they're kind of natural. This time I managed to shut them both off. So if I don't electrocute myself, I'll be able to finish this talk. I didn't say this theorem. So there is a theorem that if A is Banach isomorphic to B and A is type 1, so is B. So actually this question about the nuclear C star algebras is settled if instead you use the smaller class of type 1 C star algebras. And the real theorem is that this follows from the work of Haguru, Sukachev, and myself. Actually, we proved that for Feynman algebras, if their preduals are type 1, well, if you take two Feynman algebras and one is type 1 and its predual is Banach isomorphic to the other, then the other is type 1. So this is really about the duals of the C-star algebras. So in fact, what the real theorem is that if A star is isomorphic to B star, and A is type 1, then so is B. So we actually have a theorem about these guys, but now the question is, what's an example of a non-type 1 nuclear C star algebra? So the example that I want to talk about is the Carr algebra, and sometimes called a fermion algebra. Carr stands for canonical anti-commutation relations. And The C-star guys will tell us that that's the infinite tensor product of the 2x2 matrices, which I must confess doesn't say anything to me either. But I found an intuitive description of this guy, and so I want to just explain that and sort of promote this because I believe it's a very natural object from all kinds of points of view, the Carr algebra. And here's a Banach space description, more or less Banach space. So I'll describe a dense subspace of it. So I look at all operators. So first of all, if you want to visualize an operator on little L2, we follow Heisenberg and write it as an infinite matrix. Okay? So now I look at all operators of this type. You fix N, and now you look at a matrix of this form, AAA, it's the same guy down the diagonal, a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix of complex numbers. So actually the norm of that operator is the norm of A, which is just operating on the 2 to the n dimensional space, so it's finite. So this guy is an operator on little L2, and the Carr algebra is the closure of these. So A is a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. So for some n, well, so then to go on, I mean, I didn't define it here. Of course, I didn't define the, n is arbitrary. Right, so, you know, if you take an equals all such, then you have that the Carr is the union of the ans, n goes from 0 to infinity closure. Okay? So in other words, for each n you have a finite dimensional algebra. The thing is paved out by these finite dimensional guys. And I think it's probably better to think of it that way. So then there is also a nice object, which I'll just mention, the Peedle of a hyperfinite type 2-1 factor. So what is that thing which has all those horrible symbols in it? So the Carr algebra has a natural trace. So without defining what a trace is abstractly, you see, if you take any such matrix, then you take the normalized trace of A. And now you can define a norm, which is to be this normalized trace of the absolute value of T. The absolute value of T is nothing but the absolute value of A stuck down. And this actually defines a nice norm. And if you look at Carr under this L1 norm, its completion is this Peedle of R. So this is the thing that was discovered by Murray and von Neumann. A famous discovery that not all von Neumann algebras are type 1. I think when they started their work, this is what they thought, that the von Neumann algebras were type 1, and you know, the thing was all going to be finished. And in actually non-commutative LP, you just take the LP norm of this guy. So these are really very natural objects, and they can be presented in purely finite Banach space terms. Okay, so by the way, the Cantor set, the continuous functions on the Cantor set, if you just look at the diagonal entries in those matrices in the Carr algebra, that is actually that's isometric and algebraically isomorphic to the continuous functions on the Cantor set. And if you look at the diagonal entries in R star, you get big L1. So the commutative theory lives on the diagonal. But of course, one is kind of fascinated by the non-commutative object. So the first conjecture that I want to discuss at some length is this one. Let X be a separable operator space so that the Carr algebra, so that A completely embeds into X for all A with, for all C star algebras A, of course, this is C-star algebras. For all C-star A with A-star separable, then the Carr algebra completely embeds into X. So let me just say where I get this conjecture from, and maybe just a few words about why this is this does fit into, it may be the only thing I'll say today which fits well into what we're talking about. So in the commutative case, this is due to Bourgain, this conjecture. So it's a theorem. If A star is separable and A is commutative, what does it mean to say that A is star separable and A is commutative? Then A is isometric to C of M, algebraically isometric, where M is a countable compact metric space. So those guys are just the continuous functions on some alpha. But here is the three-line argument, which is in a very difficult paper of Bourgain's, but this is a non-hard, this is the easy part of the paper. I think it's his, well, I'm not sure which paper it appears, but anyway, so Bourgain observed this. If C of M embeds into X, separable Banach space, for every countable compact M, then the continuous functions on the unit interval embed into X. In other words, X is universal. So how does he prove this? He says, well, you look at the set of compact subsets M of 0, 1, such that C of M is isomorphic to a subspace of X. And then you observe that this is a Borel set. And if you look at all the compact subsets of the unit interval in the Hausdorff metric, this guy is a Borel set. And of course, intuitively, what else can it be? X is separable. So this is a Borel set. But if you look at the set of countable compact subsets contained in 0, 1, this is not a Borel set. So that's a classical theorem. And this is QED. There has to be one which is not countable, such that C of K embeds. And then you get that C of the Cantor set embeds. And then you get that C of 0, 1 embeds. Well, that's Newton's theorem. So OK, so this is the end of the proof. Well, this proof cannot work, I don't think, for the non-quantized situation. Nevertheless, for the quantized situation, you know, that's not going to work, but nevertheless, here's an approach, and I would bet a fair amount of money on this, so that this conjecture is correct. And here is the approach to this conjecture. We exhibit a large natural family of C-star algebras whose duals are separable. And this is going to be a subfamily indexed by the ordinals. So here I'm going to tell you the family and where it comes from. And what I'm not saying is that even though this very nice elementary use of descriptive set theory gives the commutative case, again, I'm firmly convinced that the non-commutative case will also follow by descriptive set theory. But it's a more sophisticated argument that you have to somehow show that the tree of the Carr algebra has a natural basis, in fact, a natural FDD. And that's what you have to show has length arbitrarily big, and so there must be an infinite branch. And so it's definitely in the realm of descriptive set theory that this would come out. But here's the family. So so for an AC star algebra A, I let A twiddle A hat be its unitization. So that means if you take little C0, the unitization, little C0, the unitization is C. So I start with K as a compact, and then I take its unitization. And now I take the tensor product with n times. And there is only one C star norm on that tensor product, but this little hat denotes it's often called the minimal tensor product. And then after we do that, we set A1 to be the C0 sum of all those tensor products. And then you again take the unitization. And, well, we keep going, and so I'll define them all. if A alpha is defined, then I'll set A alpha n. It'll be a unital C star algebra. A alpha n will be the n-fold tensor product. Then you take the little C zero sum of all of those guys. And finally, at limit ordinals, you just take the unitized C zero sum of all of the guys preceding. So I must confess that I came up with this family because I was trying to finish writing my handbook article on CFK spaces. This is actually where it came from. So it finally got finished. But there's this mystery that, you know, if you take C of a countable K, how come it is that actually the complete list of isomorphism classes is C of omega to the omega to the alpha? Why is this strange omega to omega to the alpha thing? And how can you run through all the isomorphism classes? So I was sort of, you know, brooding about this, and I realized, well, this is how I came up with this thing. I said, well, actually, if you start with little C0 instead of... So first of all, if I let B alpha be C of omega omega alpha plus 1, it's a naturally, completely contractively complemented subspace of A alpha. In fact, it will sit on the diagonal of those matrices. If you try to visualize A alpha as a bunch of matrices, this guy is the diagonal things. And, you know, if you start with B0 equals C and do the same construction, this is what you get. In other words, to write down all of the C of countable Ks, it may not be the most intuitive way to handle them, but this is how you get them. In other words, you take the tensor products, unitize, and you must unitize. If you just work with little C0 all the time, you don't get anywhere. You have to keep unitizing. So this is how I got these. And so the refined conjecture is this, that if A alpha completely embeds an A, so this is a separable C star algebra for all... No. This is, sorry, X is a separable operator space. I don't know why I wrote it that way. And by the way, so you see you have something concrete to work with, and the natural way to proceed is Banach space-wise, but again, the C-star algebra gives a dynamical structure which is absent in Banach spaces. You must take that into account. So by the way, all of these guys have that their duals are the trace class, at least up to isomorphism, probably constant 2 or something. So that's sort of also the natural thing. Now, I don't know if I said this, but there is a question, what are all of the C-star algebras with... I didn't say it. Another possible conjecture is that every C-star algebra with separable dual is completely isomorphic to a subspace of one of these guys. But, you know, in a sense, the things are richer, you see. But I believe that at least with the C-star algebras with separable dual, they're manageable. If you take type 1, I don't make a conjecture. I think that those are really incredibly intricate as Banach spaces. Yeah, I didn't also, I didn't state this, is I think it might be manageable to characterize what are the C-star algebras with separable duals up to Banach space isomorphism, and I would strongly bet that that's the same as the complete isomorphic classification. It's a pure Banach space question, but I think it's, you know, it's manageable but kind of challenging. So the next thing I wanted to talk about are operator space analogs of the separable extension property. So here, to save lots of time, I see that the time is really rushing along. What is it? Okay. So all about everything is going to be separable. So I'm defining various analogs of the separable extension property. And everything is inside is separable. I'm not going to keep saying that. So we're going to be looking at this diagram, And it's, we're interested in, you have a map from X to Z, and you want to know when can you extend it. And here, X, Y, and Z are going to be separable. So the classical concept is the separable extension property. SEP stands for separable extension property. So Z has a separable extension property if for all such maps, T, and X contained in Y, there is an extension. And if you can do this with the extended operator having norm at most lambda times the norm of T, then this is called the lambda separable extension property. So Subcheck in 41 proved that little c0 has the two SEP, and this is best possible. And the far deeper result, which was proved by Zipin in the late 70s, I think, is that if Z has the separable extension property, then Z is isomorphic to C0. So this is a remarkable discovery, which kind of closed the chapter, however, on this property, that SEP is little C0 is the animal. I define an operator space to have the complete separable extension property, so C stands for complete, if for all completely bounded T, there exists a completely bounded T twiddle completing this diagram, and if you can choose T twiddle to have norm CB norm at most CB norm T, then this is the lambda CSEP. Well, it turns out that this is the same as saying the thing is completely complemented in every separable operator superspace. And that's thanks to the injectivity of B of H, which I don't think I have time to discuss here. So this is the first of these quantized versions. And so, of course, you know, when one is studying a Banach space, you want to know what its complemented subspaces are, and that's for the C-star algebras. So for me, it's natural to ask what are the complemented subspaces of a C-star algebra or of an operator space. And now we have this property. So the positive theorem that we have is this result, that the C0, so this denotes the C0 sum. So for each n, I take mn infinity, direct sum m infinity n, and then I take the C0 sum of this space with itself, and this has the two complete separable extension property for all n. So, you know, I told you that an operator space should be thought of as a subspace of B of H endowed with its natural tensor product structure. So mn infinity, you just look at all operators on little l2 such that this is the first, you know, this is the first n rows. And this keeps going. So these are just all operators on little l infinity, I'm sorry, on little l2, such that they only have entries in the first n rows. And it's easy to see, actually, that that guy is isomorphic to Hilbert space itself, but this gives me the operator space structure. And similarly, m infinity n is first n columns, and as operator spaces, these are different. So the case of one row and one column are traditionally called row and column, and it's actually true that mn infinity and mn infinity is completely isomorphic to row, and mn infinity n is completely isomorphic to column, but those constants blow. So I pointed this out here. So the analog of Zipin's, you know, what Zipin's theorem really says is that every separable injective Banach space embeds into little C0. Then you get easily that it's isomorphic to little C0. So you could put it that way. So I'm now bold enough to state this as a conjecture, even though we don't have any more evidence for it, that If Z has a CSEP, then Z completely embeds into C0 over O plus column. So why this is somewhat thorny, you see, is that the real conjecture is that Z embeds into this guy, where the constant depends only on the lambda, because these guys all have the 2 SEP, but the constant blows. Well, you may notice, so this is the first quantized version of the CSEP, of the separable extension property, and the second one, help. Where is it? I can't find the slide. No. Okay, you're going to get a rare treat of having my handwriting. I'm sure this will be... I don't have the slide. So we have this... it's got to be in this pile here, but where? Here it is. Ah, you're spared. So unfortunately, K fails the CSEP. This is a result of Kirschberg's, and I must confess that when he came to Austin and told me this, I was devastated, because I thought, you know, K is the natural quantized version of little C0, and this ought to have this property, and he said, I've published a counterexample. I mean, the property hadn't been defined yet, but he said, I said, oh, no. And so it fails the CSEP. K itself does, and in fact, if you take the little C0 sum of the n by n matrices, that fails the CSEP. So that's sort of unfortunate, but then the day gets saved, because there is a culprit. And the culprit is that operator spaces don't satisfy the local reflexivity principle. So this was discovered by Efros and Hagerup, and they formulated the property for operator spaces. Actually, yes, they formulated it, but only for the constant one. But so, first let me tell you what I want to say is the definition. For the next property, and well, no, let's do this thing first. Okay. Okay, so this is the definition. An operator space is called locally reflexive if there's some constant, so that for all G contained in the double dual, and for all F contained in the dual, and for all epsilon greater than zero, there is an operator from G into X whose completely bounded norm is less than lambda plus epsilon, and T of GF is the same as GF for all G and G and F and F. Well, this is actually the way the local reflexivity principle for Banach spaces was formulated by Bill Johnson, Maury Zippin, and myself. Linus Strauss and I, this implies rather easily that G is Banach isomorphic to a subspace of X, but it does not imply that G is completely isomorphic to a subspace of X in operator space language. Anyway, we proved this principle, Johnson, Bill Johnson, and Maury Zippin, and myself, and so I've defined it for lambda. This is the lambda, so this, of course, will be the lambda. If the lambda works, you call it lambda locally reflexive, and Banach spaces have the principle for lambda equals 1. So we never defined the concept because all Banach spaces have it. But the thing is that one point of mystery and confusion is that for C-star algebras, constants are either 1 or infinity, you know. So it happens that for C-star algebra, if it's locally reflexive with some lambda, the lambda is 1. So Efros and Hagerup defined it for lambda equals 1 or not for C-star algebras. And it wasn't until I was talking to Timur and people in operator spaces, they said, well, this depends on the constant of local reflexivity. And I said, what? I thought the constant was always 1. What do you mean? And of course, for Banach spaces in general, you don't expect constants to be 1. Okay, so now the point of the definition is that is their discovery that not all C-star algebras are locally reflexive, but we make this definition an operator space is so K fails the CSEP, and we say that an operator space has a complete separable complementation property, the CSEP, if it is locally reflexive and for all locally reflexive Y and completely surjective isomorphisms T in the diagram, which I've now lost, there is a T twiddle completing the diagram. So it's the same diagram, except that now you insist that the T is a complete surjective isomorphism. And I say again, all spaces X, Y, Z are separable. So Timur Eichberg and I were able to show that the local reflexivity principle saves the day. So we proved that the compact operators themselves have the CSEP. Yeah, I didn't say it here. So nuclear C-star algebras are locally reflexive, and the constant is 1. And then it's a theorem, but it's not so obvious from the definition that the thing is hereditary. If X is lambda locally reflexive, so is every subspace. And so again, you see nuclear C-star algebras are sounding like C of K spaces. I mean, those are the guys where the natural things that you expect in Banach spaces and are happening for those C-star algebras. So this is a deep conjecture. The preceding one is not shallow by any means, because any of these conjectures imply Zipin's theorem. And on the other hand, one obviously has to deeply understand Zipin's theorem to get anywhere with these. But the conjecture is that the CSCP is characterized by subspaces of the compacts. By the way, the complemented subspaces of the compacts are also not characterized, but it's believed there's 9 of them. And if you look at all the operator spaces, I think there's less than 5,000, but I'm not sure, that are complemented subspaces. And there is a possible way of going through the list. But at any rate, I believe in the conjecture that this is the right, perhaps the right quantized version. So how come this is called the complete, well, maybe I'll leave up the definition. Okay. So why are we calling this the complete separable complementation property? Well, Eichberg and myself succeeded in proving the following equivalences. So it's not a definition, actually. It's a theorem that the following are all equivalent. Z has the CSCP. Z is completely complemented in every separable operator superspace. Z is locally reflexive. And finally, Z is completely complemented in Y. Whenever Z is contained in Y, is contained in B of H. So I'm assuming Z is stuck into B of H somehow. It doesn't make any difference how. If any particular way of sticking it in, you get this thing. So it's a complementation property, perhaps more than it is an extension property. At any rate, that's the concept. So there's a third definition, and I think in 10 minutes I'm not going to have time to discuss this and non-commutative LP spaces. So I think that I'll just say, without saying the definition, there's a problem that's been open since the 70s, which is as follows. Take an ideal which means a closed two-sided ideal in a separable C-star algebra. And the question is that complemented? Lest you think that you can easily write down a counterexample, Ando proved that it's so if the quotient algebra has a bounded approximation property. So right away we're stuck into some deep waters. Anyway, the problem is open, and if I take the compact operator stuck as an ideal in B of L2, well, that B of L2 is not separable. So, but you could stick a separable algebra between the compacts and B of L2. So we've discovered that whether or not the compacts is complemented in A, where K is contained and A is contained in B of L2, and A is separable, is equivalent to a lot of things. And for quite a while, this is a joint work with Alvaro Arias and myself. And I fervently believe that this was true for quite a while. And now I'm guessing that it's false. And of course, that would be satisfying because we'd settle this ideal problem in the negative. So that's all that I think I'll say about that, because otherwise we're just going too far. I won't have time to talk just a little bit about non-commutative LP spaces, which I alluded to before. Okay, so for non-commutative LP spaces, then I'm really mainly interested in the case where P equals 1, but we get the same results. You take Feynman algebras acting on L2, and suppose that the p-dual of 1 Banach embeds, that means isomorphically embeds in the p-dual of another, is the type of M, at most the type of N. So with Hagerup and Sukachev, we proved that type 1 implies, if N is type 1, then M is type 1, and that proves this result about the about the type 1 C-star algebras being Banach-determined, because their duals are Banach-determined, that I mentioned earlier. If N is finite, then M is finite. Well, of course, what is a finite Feynman algebra? But you should think of it as a finite measure space. That's really where the definition comes from. It's not finite dimensional. It's like a finite measure space. And then I just wanted to mention this result. This work resulted in the classification of the non-commutative of LP of N for N hyperfinite, semifinite, up to Banach isomorphism, and the classification is the same as the operator space isomorphism, and there are exactly 13 isomorphism types, of course, and it's all the same answer for P greater than or equal to 1, less than 2. And here it is, so I just wanted to put this slide up to say what it is. So SP denotes the small Schotten class, and that's the little LP sum of n-dimensional Schottens. I think the reason C got used is there was a confusion that C was supposed to, that's a Russian letter for S. But what can we do? So. Well, he was right, of course. No, but that's because the Israelis, you see, before them. So blame it on Yoram, I don't know. Anyway, here it is. So this is the picture. So what does this, this is what I got out of teaching discrete math. That you can, you always learn something, right, even if the students don't. This is called a Hasse diagram. Any partially ordered finite set has a Hasse diagram. So that's what I learned, is Hasse diagram. So the 13 spaces, there they all are. And what it means in this diagram for P, this is, of course, P is greater than or equal to 1 and less than 2. So what it means is that this guy embeds, one guy embeds in another only if you can go down the diagram to get there. So, for example, CP. They're different. So, sure. So, in other words, CP does not embed into LP of the hyperfinite type 2-1, which actually, you know what it is. We talked about it, you know, even though it's, this guy does not embed in there because you can't get to it through the diagram, but SP does. So we worked out not only that these are the 13 isomorphism types, but that these are the complete embedding properties. By the way, for P greater than 2, this is not known. I believe it should be the same diagram, but it's a whole different kettle of fish. And the fact that every non-commutative LP space is isomorphic to one of these, is which is hyperfinite and semifinite, is due to deep work of Kahn, and it's a deep result, all right, but that's not our work. It's just to say, well, Kahn does this and this and this. But the hard part is to show that, you see, you cannot go from here to here. That's really one of the main theorems, is that you can't get there. The bottom guy is what's called a hyperfinite type 2 infinity. This is our tensor B of L2. And this is the biggest one. And so what's left open is type 3. So this is to say there are other ones. So hyperfinite, help. Hyperfinite is like a sigma finite measure space. So strangely enough, sigma finite and finite, they're quite different amongst the Neumann algebras, but then there are the guys which are not sigma finite. So you could put it this way: if n is semi-finite and m star embeds into n star Banach, is it so that m is semi-finite? So that's an open problem. And recent work of Oitberg and Sturmer and myself shows that this is true if you assume M star isometrically embeds. And until recently, well, Junge and Tizier now have a theorem at least showing that sometimes it's true. I just want to say, in spite of all this, there is the problem. How do you attack a problem like this? What you really need to know is what's an example of something which is not semi-finite. So Murray and von Neumann invented these, and then it was discovered later, they sort of put them in the back door, and then later it was discovered they're kind of natural. And finally, you see, to test this conjecture, there is something called type 3. So is there a type 3 injective factor whose predual embeds into the predual of a type 2 infinity? And so, well, so the thing is, I want to show the thing is, no, of course I'm prejudiced, I believe this conjecture, but there is a natural approach, and that's what I'll conclude with, and that is the so-called Powers factors. So the Powers factors, Powers discovered that there is an uncountable family of type 3 von Neumann algebras, and for each lambda between 0 and a half, he exhibited a type 3 factor. But the fact of the matter is, and I find that whole theory, you know, very deep and hard to get, but it turns out the preduals can be very simply described, and it's the preduals we're interested in. So that's what I'm going to conclude with. What I'm doing here is trying to show that the Powers factor predual is actually an increasing union of guys which are isometric to 2 to the n dimensional trace class, and each one is contained in the next. But so you take trace class with the usual trace, and not the normalized trace, the usual trace, and now you stick the 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrices inside. You see, these are the 2 to the n plus 1. These are the 2 to the n plus 1. Well, this would be a general guy but you put the trace class norm on these, and here's what you do. So it turns out that if lambda is between 0 and a half, then you could take lambda to be a third if you like, So Hagerup and Sukachev and I proved that actually the p-duals are all completely isomorphic over different lambdas. But nevertheless, I wrote a paper a long time ago called Convolution by a Bias Coin. And if you look at the diagonal things here, you get this Bias Coin convolution operator sitting here. So what the natural approach is to show that the canonical FDD for the p-dual of this guy is reproducible in a strong sense to refute this. So it is really something concrete, although, you know, hopefully it's manageable, even though it might be hard.